to Dialogue Across Difference, an event series hosted by the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Join us as Center Director Larry Jacobs and guests engage in conversations across the political and policy spectrum on issues of the day.
Good afternoon. My name is Larry Jacobs. I'm the director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Center for the Study of Politics and Governance. Before we begin, I want to encourage you to participate, and you can do that by clicking on the Q&A button at the bottom of the screen, and we're going to get to as many of those questions as possible. And our tradition here is that I will filter the questions into the conversation that I'm having. So it's a really important part of what we'll be doing. Also, you'll notice there's a live transcript feature. And if you would like to have that transcript, please click on it. It's in process as the program is going. Our guest for today's program, Where Have All the Democrats Gone, is John Judis. John is an American author and journalist. He is serving currently as editor-at-large at Talking Points Memo. He's a former senior writer at National Journal, former senior editor at The New Republic, and we're going to be talking with him about some of his new writing, including his recently published book, Where Have All the Democrats Gone, which is co-authored with Roy Teixeira. So thank you so much, John Judis, for being with us.
Good to be with you.
So you wrote this blockbuster book that had all of us talking about in 2002 called Emerging Democratic Majorities, about how the Democrats would retake central, political control in American politics. And this was at the point at which George W. Bush was just elected. So all of a sudden people are like, what? The Democrats were excited. Republicans wondered what you were arguing. And the core argument really is about the demographic changes that were that you spotted and could see emerging Democratic, stable, enduring Democratic majority that included Blacks and Hispanics, included women, included college-educated voters. And indeed, it was just this coalition that elected Barack Obama twice. And then comes Donald Trump, and then comes really erosion from that coalition that you talked about. We now have depolarization, and I don't think we hear a whole lot of people talking about majorities. So what went wrong?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that the Democratic coalition used to be looked like a pyramid. I mean, there were people at the top. There were oil executives. There was still Hollywood, Wall Street. But, it was very strong. It was rooted really in the white working class. And the richer you went and the better educated you were, the less likely you were to be a Democrat. And things started to change sometime in probably in the 60s, accelerated in the 80s, and then really took off in the 90s. And what we spotted in the late 90s was really we knew already women were coming into the Democratic coalition. Used to be Gerry Ford in 1976 won the women's vote against Jimmy Carter. Yeah. But particularly single women, college-educated women who were in some way attuned with feminism really started coming into the party in 1980. And now I would say, and, again, look at who the two of the last three presidential nominees have been, are the single most important ideological and political force within the party. I mean, really more than unions used to be, let's say, in the 40s and 50s. So we saw that group. We saw the college-educated, the Nader generation coming out of the 1960s, civil rights, social issues, especially, again, having to do with women's rights, regulatory issues, climate change. that this group was coming into the Democratic Party, and you know, you sort of see them in the polling as professionals and postgraduates, and it's not just or you know, not primarily doctors, but it is nurses, teachers, people like that. So we figured, you know, you get minorities, women, you get professionals, and then 2006, the young start coming in. Again, 2000, Bush wins slightly the 18 to 29-year-old vote. But by 2006, it really starts to move, and then Obama, of course, captures it. You know, it looked like there was a majority there for Obama and the Democrats. And the only thing that they had to do to keep it was to hold on to about, you know, 35 to 40% of the old working class vote, primarily white, a lot based in the middle West, some in the South too, a lot of factories in the South. If they could hold on to 40% of that vote, then they could keep some kind of majority. It wouldn't be a smashing majority like Roosevelt had, but it would be something that was significant, would allow them to move forward with their legislation. So that really starts to fall apart in 2010. And again in 2014 in those congressional elections, and the climax is that Trump defeating Hillary Clinton in 2016. And what we see then is not a Republican majority, but a kind of unstable equilibrium between the parties, where they're roughly at equal strength, and they keep changing who's on top depending upon whose most egregious aspects come to the fore. So in 2018, people were voting against Trump. They were voting against the Republicans trying to wreck the healthcare system, and that, you know, that was a big reason that the Democrats won in 2018, and again in 2020. If the issue is going to be immigration, if it's going to be trade, if it's going to be extreme views on social issues, then the Republicans are going to have an advantage. And, you know, that's part of what made it possible for Trump to win in 2016 and really to capture about 70% of this white working class vote that used to be the bulwark, it used to be the edifice on which the Democratic coalition was built. So, you know, we have this strange, almost hourglass phenomenon in American politics where Democrats are not, you know, they have their people at the top, but like the upper middle of the hourglass is filled with Democrats. And then a lot of the lower middle, particularly Hispanic and Blacks, working class is filled with Democrats. But the middle class, a lot of that has fled. And it's not a viable situation if you're for legislation and proposals that will shift power in America from the top to the bottom, in the middle. I mean, we have this kind of, you know, Bernie Sanders calls it an oligarchy. And I think that's a fair description, where these billionaires have this inordinate power over our politics, over who runs universities. We found that out this year, too. Again, what kind of legislation gets passed and how it's how in the end, in the execution of it, it gets screwed up. What we need to do in order to have that kind of politics in America, just the politics, again, that it characterized a lot of European countries since World War II, is really to reclaim a democratic majority that unites the bottom and the middle and the, again, in order to do that, we have to win back a lot of the working class that left during the early 2000s.
Great. Thank you so much, John. So you published this year a follow-on book called Where Have All the Democrats Gone? And it fills in the story that you're telling. And part of it is a multi-decade embrace by the Democrats of globalization, deregulation, kind of a dogma about free markets. We saw this certainly with Bill Clinton through Obama. And there was also, you describe what you see as a kind of cultural extremism. And I want to talk a little bit about that because it's such a critical part of the Democratic Party, particularly the interest groups and the activists around the party. This involves immigration, but it also involves sexual identity. And, you know, we could see some of that flaring up even recently with J.D. Vance's criticism of Tim Walz as Tampon Tim, and some of Donald Trump's criticism of Democrats for providing tampons and boys' rooms and so forth. What is the role of this cultural radicalism that you see? Why is it radical?
Well, it's radical really because there's ways to do these things that don't involve going to extremes and alienating a majority of American voters. I mean, American voters are for protections of the rights of people who are transgendered. They start getting squeamish about people who were born male going into women's sports, competitive women's sports. So there's always, there is a kind of, again, an extreme. Reform the police, don't defund them, for instance. Immigration. We can raise legal immigration if we want, but it's the law. And we can't have a situation where the border really is out of control. And Biden made some mistakes right at the beginning of his administration in terms of loosening the terms on which people could seek asylum so that, you know, if you could claim domestic abuse, if you could claim that you were in a dangerous neighborhood, which, you know, a lot of people in the world are, you could come to the United States. This asylum was really started for with the German Jews and the Nazis in mind. It's political asylum, political refugees. But the definition got redefined. Smugglers began to take advantage of it, get people to come across the border, and they would do it for a fee. And so we had this enormous rush in the first 2 or 3 years of the Biden administration of people seeking asylum who were not legal immigrants into the country. And that became a big problem for Biden and for the Democrats, and it still is. I mean, I'd say it's the counterpart to the Dobbs decision and abortion in this election. So that's, again, immigration is an economic and a social issue. But again, if you want to talk about a social issue where, again, comprehensive reform. Do something about the people who are in this country who are undocumented, but secure the borders. And in 2016, one of the notable things was that aspect, securing the borders, was totally missing, and so it provided this enormous opening for Trump. So I think that's what we're talking about cultural radicalism.
Yeah, and thank you for that. And for folks who are kind of just tuning in here, one of the really unique things about John Judas is he's combining a kind of economic liberalism and support for government intervention, particularly in cases where there is need and gaps in terms of what markets provide. But there's also a kind of a caution around some social issues. And for instance, and this is, you know, the Donald Trump campaign against Kamala Harris, who, you know, back during the primary in 2020 talked about decriminalizing unauthorized border crossings. She seemed to be offering praise for defund police, proposals and discussions. And you're saying, careful with that. That really is part of, it's part of this recipe that has undone what might otherwise have been a new majority for the Democratic Party.
Well, it would have given them an edge. They would certainly would have gotten the House in 2022. They wouldn't have lost it because a lot of those House seats in New York were lost on the defund the police issue and crime. So, yes. I mean, the other thing that the Democrats have problems in elections where I am divided myself on is issues that involve a lot of spending that would require higher taxes. So, you know, if you ask me, I'm for Medicare for all. I'm single payer. But as a, again, as a political issue, you have to steer clear of that because Americans, this goes back to the revolution, are weary of big government. And unless you're in a kind of crisis situation where you can pull it off and then see the results and win people over, it's very hard to campaign on big spending issues like that. And the, you know, the Harris campaign so far has been pretty good. I mean, I think her economic proposals do not involve, huge amounts of spending. And she has a tax, some tax, corporate tax thing to do, but price gouging, encouraging housing, things like that. So yes, that's fine. And she's also not playing the identity card, which Hillary Clinton did in 2016, and which she did in that speech last night about the glass ceiling. It's very, you know, again, Obama understood this. People want to vote for the most qualified person for president. They don't want to see it as an affirmative action hire. And, you know, Trump and Vance are going to try to paint Kamala Harris that way. And so far, she's done a very good job of not saying to people, you should vote for me because I'm a woman or because I'm black or because I'm mixed race. It's because I have the best plan for the future.
So let's go back. Let's pursue the Kamala Harris theme. There's a lot of polling out. Pew Charitable Trust, particularly the Pew Research Center, had a report out a few days ago entitled "Harris Energizes Democrats," and in it, it talks about the new reality in the presidential election, in which Harris's support is now comparable to Trump's. The enthusiasm gap, which had favored Trump, is gone. They have now about comparable levels of enthusiasm. And this is where I come to you, John Judas. It appears that the new Democratic majority that you wrote about in 2002 is also at least coming into some kind of form where you've got new support and highly motivated Blacks, Hispanics, Asians, young and college educated. Does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah. Rui and I should reissue our book. Yes, I think I might have even said that to you previously. This election looks to me like 2016, but hopefully with a better Democratic candidate and with a Republican candidate who's been more discredited than in 2016. It's the post January 6th version of Donald Trump. So, yes, that's very much what it looks like. And I don't see this as a transformative election in that sense. I don't think that, again, Harris is going to have to do as well as Biden did among white working class voters. He didn't do great. He get, let's say, about, I think it was about 37% in Pennsylvania. And Clinton was in the low 30s. So, he again, in those kind of states, she has to do pretty much what he's going to do, but she's not going to transform the Democratic Party in this election. Hopefully she'll win, and if it's by 273 to 265, that'll be fine with me.
Okay, we're going to come to that in a second. And folks, if you're there with a question, I know some of you already sent some in, please share your questions with us. So what would a transformation by Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party look like? What is it that you think would need to happen? Because a lot of folks, would say, oh, yeah, this looks like a pretty progressive Democrat who's being clever in terms of her presentation of, progressive ideas and what it sounds like conservative language about opportunity and freedom. But you're saying she's missing, she's not yet transforming. What does John Judas transformation look like?
Well, first of all, let's talk about some of the things we would need to do. I mean, the safety net in America, the extent to which people can feel secure about their lives, is just minimal compared to Europe. I got a bill. I hate to bring myself in here, but I went to the eye doctor for an examination because I had cataracts. And I got a bill for $230 afterwards. I said, "What's this for? You know, I pay for Medicare. I have Medigap. Even that part of our healthcare system is leaky. The Obamacare thing, you have to have an advanced degree to figure out, I mean, which policy." So again, we need a much better safety net in America. We need a situation where workers don't feel so insecure about their jobs. In order to do that, we have to return to something like what we had after World War II, where a third of the workforce was unionized, so that there was this kind of countervailing power, both in the workplace and in politics, to the power of business and to the power of big money. So how do we get there? I mean, there are two things would have to happen. You have to have a change in the parties. You have to have some kind of party situation where the Democrats represent, as they did from 1932 until roughly 1968, the bottom and middle of the electorate. So again, you can unite on reforms that benefit that part. But you also have to have pressure from the bottom. You have to have organized labor. You have to have organized movements. The internet gives us this kind of illusion of unification. I mean, you had the protests and riots that break out in 2020 over police brutality. Now, you know, great, but in retrospect, it all dissipates. And the reason it dissipates again is that we're not talking about organized movements. We're talking about virtual movements almost that don't have organized leadership. Now, how do you get to that situation? You get to that situation, I think. I mean, it's a kind of chicken and egg thing, but the Democrats have to be in a position where they have sufficient majorities in Congress where they can reform our labor laws. And they just have not had that. Obama had it in 2009, but he was again pressured by business interests within the Democratic Party not to go after reforming the labor laws and instead to put other things as a priority. Biden, you know, really does understand that, and he's been one of the, you know, he has been our best president on that issue, but he had a, what, 50-50 majority in the Senate. He was not in a position to do that. But I think it's going to be hard to build up an organized base and power from below unless we do something from above. So again, sadly speaking, is some kind of another recession or critical situation where the Democrats gain a majority and gain a big majority and then seek to do something about it in terms of power below, organizing power below. I mean, you can remember the Obama movement after 2008. It all disappears. Obama for America, what was it called? And then it becomes what, Democrats for America or something, and it's gone within 2 years. So have to have power from below, and then you have to have some kind of party thing. But we're pretty far from that still. I don't see that happening in this coming decade. I see more the kind of unstable equilibrium and the parties shifting in power. I mean, you know, and I guess like many Democrats, the worst thing I fear is just the chaos of another Trump administration. because he's gotten a lot worse since 2016, and he's going to have worse people around him this time than he had in his first administration. So, you know, that's, we're not talking about fascism or Nazis, but it's scary. We don't, it's unpredictable. You don't know what could happen, and it might be very bad.
So, John, you know, you're kind of bringing together some ideas and thinking that don't usually come together. And I know that you've been part of a group of people thinking about kind of economic progressivism and this cultural moderation. Folks who don't follow this, you know, I'd recommend, as I think John would, American Affairs, which is a publication. It was inspired by a group of people who had supported Donald Trump during the 2016 election and supported his attack on American elites for some of the same reasons John's talking about. And I'm just curious, John, how do you find yourself, you know, writing, publishing, and talking with people who appear, at least on the outside, to be so different in basic motivation from, you know, the kind of democratic socialism that you have, you know, discussed and promoted for so many years?
Well, which people that I'm talking with? I mean,
well, I think American Affairs is a really...
Oh, those people. Yeah. You know, I knew, I did it. I wrote a book called The Populist Explosion.
Yes.
And Harvey Mansfield, who's a conservative at Harvard, invited me up there to give a talk. And this guy, Julius Krein, was in the audience. And afterwards, we talked, and he said he's going to start this magazine called American Affairs, funded by initially by Peter Thiel, of all people. And
just a time out there. So Peter Thiel is big funder of Donald Trump.
Yes. And if, he was Vance's main funder. He was also Ted Cruz's big funder. So, yes, major figure of Silicon Valley money. And so Julia said he wanted to have this kind of synthesis of the left and the right. And that's, you know, that was American Affairs. And he broke very quickly with Trump over Charlottesville. And there, you know, there's another publication called Compact that I sometimes write for that's trying to do the same thing. But again, I just don't know how much influence that they're going to have. So there, I mean, there are factions again within the Republican Party, especially within the intelligentsia, and there's factions within the Democratic Party, some Bernie people that are thinking along the same lines of economic progressivism and cultural moderation, but. I don't know whether they're going to be able to come together in a politically organized form other than in small magazines and websites.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as someone who publishes in small magazines, I think I understand and understand where you're coming from. But on the, you're such a, you know, pragmatic person, and particularly your recent books have been filled with kind of thinking of, about how to create these syntheses of progressive economic ideas with a more moderate approach to cultural issues. And I'm just curious, how do you see that working out? Because I look at the Democratic Party and some of the most powerful interests are advocating for, you know, a kind of racial equality, a loosening of borders, of sexual identity that you find so harmful. How does that happen? Because that is like the teeming activism and energy of the Democratic Party. How are you thinking about that?
Well, you know, that's the kind of thing that that defeat would sober. I think again, if the Democrats were to suffer a big defeat, I think that people would be worried about that. But that's where a lot of the energy is coming, and it comes from the again from the entry into the Democratic Party, beginning in the 80s or so, but going, you know, even going back to the 60s, of college-educated people more concerned with social issues, regulatory issues, climate change, than with kind of bread-and-butter economics. And within our big media and the big metro areas, they constitute a kind of political vanguard. and determine a lot of the way that Democrats think. But again, I think a lot of Democratic politicians learned something from 2016, and to some extent also from 2020 and 2022, where they did lose the House, and they're making an effort to moderate on these issues and focus on the economy and focus on social stands that are acceptable to majorities. So, you know, it is possible, but again, I mean, I find it hard sometimes to find places to publish my articles because what liberal means and what left means has become so extreme.
Yeah, and you know, it's, you know, to be particularly the DNC today or yesterday this week, and to talk about, you know, these energetic elements of the party, you know, acquiescing, or, you know, could you quiet down, or will you let us finesse your position because it doesn't work in terms of winning election. That's a tough pitch.
Yeah, well, look at Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She is a smart broad. I mean, that was a brilliant speech last night. She does understand the politics and how far she can go and how far she can't go. And I was very impressed.
Great. We've got a bunch of questions here. Several of the questions are kind of wondering about whether the Harris-Waltz ticket has, you know, moderated on and their positioning on economic issues. Several questions point to the size of the budget under Tim Walz, which increased by 40%. Why should we trust the Harris-Waltz administration on taxes and the economy, given that record?
You know, we're going to know more after the first debate between, and it might be the only debate between Harris and Trump. The election is to some extent going to turn on personalities, and particularly on Trump's personality. And it's fine for Harris and Walz to avoid really detailed kinds of programs that open them up to all kinds of arcane discussions about deficits and things like that, and to concentrate on a few very general things. They're going to have trouble with the economy because of inflation. Inflation is a killer for presidents. You can ask Jimmy Carter in 1980. But it's gone down. It's moderated to some extent. Still, that's a big issue. They're vulnerable there. So they're going to have to hope that fears about Trump, the issue of abortion, health care. Again, the Republicans tried to wreck what we have, the Affordable Care Act, that those kind of issues are going to come to the fore and will be more salient than inflation, immigration. So it's just a question of who can pull that off. I think that also what her becoming the nominee has raised the issue of age again, but in a way that benefits the Democrats. One thing that Rui and I didn't anticipate when we wrote the emerging Democratic majority was this block of young voters coming into the Democratic Party. It really was split in 2000, and I think even in 2024. Between Kerry and Bush. But boy, in 2006, in the wake of the Iraq War, Katrina, climate change, then you get the Great Recession. This is a big group of voters. And I think they've been energized by her. And I think, you know, it's sort of the TikTok vote. And the Harris campaign is putting a lot of money and a lot of people into that vote and into that aspect of American life, social media. So we'll see how it works out. But that, again, I think is a strength for them. And I don't think it's going to matter a fig what Minnesota's budget was or stuff. I don't think that'll come up. And, you know, he's the vice president. unless you can find that he broke the law and killed somebody or something like that, that's not going to be a big issue. She's going to carry it, and whether she can really pull it off, we'll have a good idea of after that debate.
On this issue of young people, we've got several questions. One is a concern about young people who see themselves as transgender or are allies of transgenders. And the question is, what would be a moderate response to the needs of transgender people?
No discrimination in employment and housing. That's a moderate response.
How about if a transgender person wanted to participate in women's sports?
Well, I'm against that. I was a jock, and I think Title IX has just done marvels for women, and created a whole a new world of women's sports. We're big WNBA fans in our house, and there's problems there. There might not be problems with 7-year-olds, but when you get to the high level of competitive sports, then yes, then that is a problem. And if you look at the polling on it, a majority of Americans are queasy about it. It's not an issue like some of the stuff that J.D. Vance talks about, where he's down on women who don't have children. That's not a popular issue, but wanting to have some regulations about biological men participating in women's sports, that's a place where I think the Democrats should be very careful and not embrace the position, let's say, of the ACLU.
Another question on young voters, particularly their commitment to climate change. Would that be helpful in terms of winning back working class vote into the Democratic Party?
Probably the opposite. When you start talking about these, again, climate change, real thing, but a lot of the proposals that come out of the Democrats and come out of some of these groups like Sunrise are apocalyptic in nature. We're going to get rid of all carbon emissions in the United States by 2030. It's just not going to happen. We're going to stop airplanes from going. It gets to an extent where it really starts to scare people. And you see that in Europe, with the rise of the right-wing populace, really inspired to a great extent by climate change policies that don't seem to take like farmers into account. So, I think that's more an elite issue where that we do have to do something about it. But again, be very careful about the way it's framed. And not do it in such a way as to scare the hell out of people, because I think that's been the strategy, and it's just not. It's not a matter of being bad politics. It's also bad science, because it's not going to happen. It's going to take a long time for us to resolve this problem.
There was, of course, an effort by the Biden administration and Democrats and some Republicans to pass legislation on infrastructure that would address climate change while also creating working class jobs. Is that a kind of a synthesis that you have in mind in terms of moving
forward?
Well,
it's fine. I'm all in favor of that, but it's more a panacea, or it's more an illusion than a synthesis. My former colleague Noam Scheiber at the New York Times did an article about how many jobs would be created by the so-called the Green New Deal, and it's mainly construction jobs at the beginning, but there really isn't this kind of it's not a path to full employment. Ditto the CHIPS Act. The CHIPS Act, very important for American to make those kind of things, but it's not going to reverse the decline of manufacturing in America. It's going to sort of keep it at its pace, and it'll get us It'll get keep us into a very important part of what's produced, steel also, but it's not going to add an incredible number of jobs.
You know, it's been interesting listening to Donald Trump's reaction to Kamala Harris, particularly after her speech last week about her economic proposals. And we started to see rehabilitation of language around communism and socialism and so forth. And, you know, as someone who's not been shy about being a democratic socialist, do you think socialism, the phrase socialism, has lost its kind of negative pejorative meaning? Is it something that now can be talked about publicly? Is it something that Kamala Harris has to be worried about and kind of get the fire brigade out there?
I think it can be talked about in some zip codes in New York State and California. Maybe Montgomery County, our county executive, was a member of the New American Movement, and I think is also a DSA, though he's not an active member. No, I think it's a lot of people are still scared of that, and Venezuela really hasn't helped the reputation of what it means to be a socialist. You know, I guess both my friend Rui and I come out of the socialist left, but I think we're more comfortable with being called social democrats than socialists, because a lot of the people who identify as socialist in the United States advocate stuff that, you know, was way beyond us. Abolish prisons, friendship missions to Venezuela, stuff like that. It's not going to be. Bernie Sanders and I are the same age. I mean, we're both, you know, leaving the scene, and AOC has backed away from that identification, if you notice. So, you know, what I'm hoping for is what I called in a book I wrote, shadow socialism, which is to say the same thing, but not with the onus of the name upon it. Yeah, and I want to say one thing too, about this price gouging issue, which Trump called communism. And what's disturbed me about it is how all these economists have jumped upon Harris, including Obama people, Jason Furman. You can't do this. Now, if you go back and look at the early 70s, when Nixon did wage price control in 1971, 72, that was one of the things that got him elected in a landslide. It was very popular and actually worked, and he got intimidated out of it the next year. Carter comes in 76, and he has a big meeting with business leaders, and he promises to them that he won't do wage price controls unless he gets approval by Congress. So when it comes up in 79 and 80 and nearly destroys, I mean, really does destroy his administration, the inflation, he can't do anything about it because he doesn't have majorities in Congress that are in favor. So it's not, it really, you know, worked in World War II. It's not an unproven tactic. And her proposals for it might not be appropriate anymore because the inflation has started to go down. But to call that communism and then for Democrats to come say, well, yeah, that's ridiculous. It's an idiotic thing to talk about. Price gouging by corporations is just beyond belief for me. And it's, again, it's that you're seeing there the kind of views that have allowed the Democrats to stray away from their old New Deal roots.
Yeah, and of course, if you look at corporate profits, under pandemic years and after, they've used the shortage to have sustained high profits. And I think probably what's going on in the Harris campaign is a political calculation that rather than talking about inflation coming down, which was what Biden did, they're better off to get the populist bandwagon and talk and go after corporations, even if it's not a very clear policy, even if they're going to be
right.
Vague.
Nothing's going to come of it, but it's
nothing's going to come of it.
But it's good. It's not bad economics, and it's actually good politics.
It could be terrible economics, but yeah. It's unclear if it'll ever come to that.
Yeah.
Hey, I want to ask you about something you talk a lot about in your new book, which is You describe it as the shadow parties. And I know you like this term shadow.
I know, I realize that. I used shadow in a bunch of
So, I'm a political scientist, so I think of political parties as organizations and institutions.
Right.
Shadow wouldn't be the word that I usually think of, and I certainly don't offer it to my students. Though I've got a couple colleagues who use that phrase, shadow parties. I'm curious, what do you mean by shadow? Isn't a political party an organization, an institution? It's got resources, it's got structures in place, it's in charge of nominations. I mean, help me.
Well, you know, American parties are different from European parties, which are really organized membership groups that vote on platforms and whose members elect their leaders, etc. It's a much, much different. We've always had, to some extent, decentralized, amorphous, groups that are parties. But what you really had, for much of the 20th century was a kind of situation that, your political scientists going back to VOP, parties, politics, and pressure groups,
Quiz on that later, folks.
where you had a key institutions whose leaders themselves constituted a kind of ruling clique that dominated the party, and to some extent also dominated the other party as well. But so you had the leaders of organized labor, you had people from Wall Street, and and the Democrats used to be the Jewish parts of Wall Street, and Hollywood, oil. So you had a kind of definable group, and they had their periodicals like Foreign Affairs. They had their think tanks like Brookings. And so you could sort of, the way my old friend Bill Domhoff used to do, identify a group and say who rules America and who rules the parties. But that's really changed in the internet age. And we are in a situation now where we hit, where it's very hard to identify centers of power in a way that you might have done 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, and where the Democratic Party itself becomes defined by publications, Substacks, web pages, just a bevy of institutions, ACLU, the Roosevelt Institute, etc., that constitute a kind of shadow party. So you could have a situation, let's say in 2020, where you couldn't find a Democrat politician who actually advocated defund the police, but where Democratic candidates like Jamie Harrison, the guy in Carolinas who was running, get branded by it because the party itself has become identified through the protests, through the media, through the think tanks. Again, the on the transgender issue, you're not going to find any politicians who are going, we have to have these guys in women's sports. But again, it becomes identified with the party. So that's what I was talking about in terms of a shadow party.
I mean, we've always had, pressure groups, and we've described, as you said, political parties in America as being an umbrella for, distinct interests. And there have been folks who've been very critical of the Democratic Party, for instance, for decades, for a quote-unquote barren marriage with labor, because labor, it wasn't a labor party. It was one interest among others.
Right.
So what's the difference? I mean, it just seems like, okay, they're different groups, but our parties have always been kind of an accumulation. Today, they're advocating for a different set of issues, including issues around sexual identity, racial justice. The Democratic Party constellation is different, but it's the party it's different.
Well, it just look, in the 1950s, about 30 to 33% of American non-farm families had a union member in them. The AFL-CIO 1955 forms as a federation. It's a big deal. you had business leaders. You had a set of defined American corporations that had been around, General Motors, General Electric. You didn't have this kind of penumbra of organizations that exist now. You also had big newspapers in cities with editorial boards that had a lot to say over who was going to be the nominee of parties. Again, a lot of those have disappeared. New York Times now says they're not even going to say who they want for New York, which is crazy to me. The power again in this sense has been dispersed in a way that it wasn't. It's also opened the door to the billionaires, to individuals having enormous amounts of power that you really didn't see again 40 years ago, 50 years ago.
So it's interesting, folks. This is like a little bit of a light seminar on ideas about power. But if you go back to the 50s and 60s, there was a critique. C. Wright Mills and others talked about an elite, a power elite that controlled the commanding heights of business and the military and politics. And they kind of stitched together the power as it was being used. And what John Judas is saying is that has kind of collapsed and power is now dispersed. Fair point. I don't think people who study this would disagree in any way. But what I find interesting, John, is that you don't see this as an opening. Because the criticisms in the 50s and the 60s had this idea, maybe it was naive, that if the power elite kind of crumbled, then there would be opening for kind of this autonomous citizen activism, what you kind of described in not so flattering terms as a shadow party. I mean, isn't that like a vanguard for a different kind of citizen-based politics?
What happened was that beginning in the 1970s, you get really a transformation of the power in Washington. And we're not even talking about parties here, though, when we get to that, where business interests become very wary of the possibility of an alliance between the new left and unions. Big strikes at the end of the 1960s, GE strike. And that's the era when you start to get business organizing in Washington. There wasn't something called K Street. K Street's the big street that runs through Washington in 1970. People wouldn't have known what you were referring to. But all these lobbying firms, Business Roundtable, all these think tanks that are supposedly objective, but in fact are arms of particular business interests that fund them, start popping up in the 1970s. And, we have a proliferation of those now in Washington. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, labor unions come under attack. They start to decline precipitously in the 1980s in Reagan. So you get much less economic power from below. You get the like Public Citizen and Nader. You get a few things, but again, vastly different from the way it was in the 1950s. You do get a lot of powerful groups that come out of the 60s and out of the social issues and consumer issues and environmental issues. So Washington becomes dominated to a great extent by this alliance between business groups and you could call them socially liberal groups. And it's clearest in George H.W. Bush's administration where, he can go to only certain limits in the Civil Rights Act. He has a pretty strong reaffirmation of the environmental acts of 1971 that started the EPA.
That's
think why the Dobbs decision was so startling to people, because all of a sudden, this kind of informal alliance where you had Goldman Sachs, with gay liberation and all this stuff, all of a sudden abortion can become illegal again. And so that was an enormous shock to people. We're sort of winding around here. I'm sorry, but that's the
I think...
to describe this kind of this weird situation, how power has.
Yeah, and I think it helps to explain, your critique of the Democratic Party today. We're almost out of time, but we have a few more minutes. Folks are interested. We've got three more nights for the Democratic National Convention. What are you looking for? What would be missteps? What needs to happen?
Oh, I just look for good speeches. I watch a baseball game on my computer monitor, and I have the convention on. And when it's a boring speech, I turn up the sound on baseball, and vice versa.
Where do you think things will be in a week, or in 2 weeks, as we get out of?
Oh, I think she'll get a bounce. I think she. I'm hoping she gives a good speech. But the debate, look at the debate. That's going to be the first time when people can really compare the two candidates. I think that's the crucial thing.
If you look back to 2016, Hillary Clinton came out of this period with actually a sizable lead. And there was an assumption that she would win. And, there were a number of, mistakes that the Clinton campaign made out of complacency. What is the big mistake out of the Clinton campaign in 2016 that Kamala Harris needs to be in the lookout for?
Oh, I think I've already talked about that. I'm with her, the identifying too much, allowing herself to be painted as an affirmative action candidate, as a black candidate, or as a woman's candidate, and not as a candidate for America, for, for all Americans. I think that's the biggest mistake that she could make.
I found it interesting, and I agree with you about that. I found it interesting the way in which Harris has kind of flipped the script a bit. Biden was trying to run on give me credit for what I've done. And Harris is kind of giving up on that to a large extent. Instead, she's taking the mantle of the change candidate, which is not usually what happens with the incumbent, party's candidate. They're usually, right, heralding what they've done. She doesn't seem that interested in it. She's, running against inflation. She's running for, important changes in economic policy.
It's very clever the way her campaign has been designed. I absolutely agree. And the future themes goes back to Gary Hart in 1984. That was the Pat Caddell and the whole idea that you have to run on the future Biden, it looked for a while that he was going to be running on the past, and that was going to be a disaster. And that theme has allowed her to distinguish herself.
Last question. This is from one of our friends tuning in. Do you think the United States is ready for a woman president?
Oh, sure. I don't think that's a problem.
Just don't talk about it.
Well, no, that's different. People don't want to be voting for somebody. I mean, there are women who are going to vote for her because she's a woman, but you don't have to remind them of that. They can see that with their own two eyes, but you don't want to inflame the battle of the sexes by saying, that's the point I'm making.
John Judas, thank you so much for spending time with us. I just want to mention a few upcoming events. September 12th, we've got Rick Hasson, who's a law professor at University of California at Los Angeles. He is a well-known and outstanding student and academic and analyst of threats to the elections. That's going to be a great program. Jennifer Morell will be joining us. She's one of the top election experts in the country. That's September 12th. It'll be noon Central Time. If you're interested in those issues, this is going to be a great program. We started a series called Conservative Voices. Robert Doerr, the president of the American Enterprise Institute, will be with us to talk about conservative approaches to poverty, looking forward to that. October 2nd, we've got a great program. It's going to look at racial realignment and whether this is happening during this election. There has been talk about the shift, particularly among voters of color who are working class, towards the Republican Party. Kamala Harris may have stem that, but we'll see. We've got a great program coming up. That's October 2nd, again, noon Central Time. And then we've got two of our favorite people, Democratic and Republican political consultants, who'll be joining us. Rebecca Piercy, who was Elizabeth Warren's campaign manager, and Kirsten Kukowski, who was the communications head for a number of Republicans. So that's going to be great. That's coming up October 9th. If you haven't heard these two, tune in. They are really fun to listen to and very candid. Finally, I just want to let you know, if you're interested in this, there will be a video and a podcast of this in all your favorite settings. If you've enjoyed this and you'd like to see this kind of program continue, please consider giving a donation. We appreciate that, as does my staff. So once again, John Judas, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a
my pleasure
to visit with you again. Take care.
Bye.
See you, folks.